Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the nation heads into Memorial Day weekend, the news is all about war abroad and immigration at home. President Bush warns it will be a bloody summer in Iraq.
We're going to expect heavy fighting in the weeks and months. We can expect more American and Iraqi casualties.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid tried to explain why Democrats gave up on troop withdrawal deadlines in the war funding bill.
I don't think there's any way you could stretch saying whatever we decide to do in this legislation is a defeat. For heaven's sakes, look where we've come.
And a giant immigration bill just may have a chance. Here's Senator Ted Kennedy.
It provides tough new enforcement at the border and the worksite. It allows a realistic path to family security and eventual citizenship for millions of men, women, and children already here.
This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. It has been a hot stretch in the nation's capital, and we've got a great panel from Washington to dive in with us. Jack Beatty is off this week, but joining me from Washington is Susan Milligan, national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Susan, great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also joining us from Washington, Jonathan Capehart, editorial board member at the Washington Post, previously part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial team at the New York Daily News. Jonathan Capehart, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
And heading into this Memorial Day weekend, we're joined by Gina Cavallaro, reporter for the Army Times, an independent paper, part of the Gannett News Company, which has been out front on soldiers' health issues. Gina's been embedded with troops six times since the Iraq War began. Gina, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
Jonathan, let's go straight to you on the funding bill. President Bush was in the Rose Garden celebrating before the vote even finally came through. It's being described by your paper as a big victory for the president. Does that mean it's a big loss for the Democrats, or how's it being interpreted?
It's not a victory for the Democrats. The Democrats came into the majority in Washington on the backs of a very strong anti-war sentiment from the anti-war wing of the Democratic Party, and they felt very strongly coming in January that they had to get the president to change course, to start bringing the troops home. And what ended up happening yesterday was that they passed a bill that gave up on, at least for now, forcing the president to bring the troops home sooner rather than later.
Let's listen to some tape first from the president. This was in the Rose Garden before the final vote, but you could see it coming. President Bush said that he had achieved success by getting Democrats to remove timetables for withdrawal from the Iraq War spending bill.
Do you want politicians making those decisions, or do you want commanders on the ground making the decisions? My point is that I would trust David Petraeus to make an assessment and a recommendation a lot better than people in the United States Congress.
Of course, Democrats had talked a lot about deadlines, and many saw their victory last fall as closely related to dissatisfaction over the war in Iraq. As Jonathan Capehart says, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said yesterday she doesn't like this war funding bill. She's not going with it. She and other prominent Democrats, including Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, voted against the bill.
So when I look at this ink blot, I see something that does not have adequate guidelines and timetables, something that does not have adequate consequences, and something that does not have my support.
Congressman Rahm Emanuel, Democrat of Illinois, tried to explain to Capitol Hill reporters why Democrats had given up their demand for a withdrawal date in the war spending bill and accepted softer benchmarks.
It ends the blank check on more troops, more money, more time, and more of the same. And it begins the notion that we have to have a new direction to Iraq that has accountability, standards, that you can measure progress or not, and the notion that what we've done in the past doesn't work.
Democrat Rahm Emanuel. Susan Milligan, we don't want to pretend here. Was there ever a chance that the Democrats were going to go all the way to the wall and leave the troops without funding this summer?
No. I think particularly nobody really wanted to go into the Memorial Day weekend with this thing left undone. I mean, the bottom line is they just didn't have the votes. They did push it. They voted. They got vetoed. They tried to override the veto. They couldn't do it. But they're going to keep coming back at them, including during the summer, and they're going to keep trying to put restrictions on the president's authority. They're actually going to try to deauthorize the war this summer. And I think what they're hoping is that the Republicans will find it harder and harder to vote against some of these bills, particularly as the support for the war, already very low, continues to drop.
Gina Cavallaro, what about within the military? What's your sense of how this long back and forth between the Democrats in Congress and President Bush was interpreted by officers and troops? Did they fear that the funds actually might not be there? Is it, you know, what's their, what are they taking away from this big debate we've seen in Washington?
Well, you've got the officers in Washington. I think there's been a lot of nail-biting and hand-wringing over the possibility that this money would not come in time. They've already been through this last year. This is the supplemental funding that they rely on to fund this war, and this is the 2000 supplemental. So I think it's been difficult for them to wait. I don't think they thought they wouldn't get the money, but the later they get the money, the harder it is for them to reset their equipment and provide things and continue programs that were already underway. As for the troops on the ground over in Iraq, they've got some other problems on their mind. I don't think that they're keeping track of the issues here in Washington as closely as we are. We have to remember that when you're on the ground over there, it looks a lot different than it does over here in Washington.
You've been paying attention to issues, very straightforward things like force protection and body armor. Even now, those are issues after all these years and all these billions, Gina?
Well, I think the body armor issue, the body armor has been upgraded several times since they've been over there. I know soldiers who have been saved by bullets that have struck their body armor. And the recent report on NBC about the dragon skin body armor, which is a body armor that works like a chainmail, like the medieval chainmail, where it moves with you, and it's a series of overlapping scales, if you will. The tests are in dispute, but I think a bigger issue right now is the issue of acquisition of more V-shaped hull armored vehicles, which the Army is suddenly going to up dramatically the number they were going to buy.
And, of course, the body of one of the missing three troopers was found this week in Iraq, but still two out there. This has been tough, and so many soldiers put on this job, Gina.
Very, very tough. It is very difficult. And this happened just 1 year ago in the same exact area. Those soldiers that went missing last year were found within 4 days. Their bodies were mutilated and booby-trapped, so they finally recovered them. But this is going a lot longer. These soldiers have been missing since May 12th. I don't know what intelligence they have where they can determine that they think they're still alive, but it's very, very difficult on the troops on the ground. It's tiring. The commanders don't really have a way of looking at this enormous effort search that is tactically difficult, but it's also emotionally difficult. When do you look at your troops and say, okay, they're past their peak performance, they're tired, but they can't stop. They've got to keep doing what they're doing until they find them.
Jonathan Capehart, where does this Iraq war debate go from here? The president says it's going to be a long, bloody summer. He said at the Coast Guard Academy graduation service in midweek that, you know, Al-Qaeda's moved in here, and if we don't defeat them there, they're going to come and get us here in the United States. On the other hand, some indications in his press conference yesterday that he's ready to talk with the neighbors, look at the Iraq Study Group proposals, which could include getting out of there. So how does this unfold?
It's all about September. If you notice, there's one thing in the president's press conference yesterday that I found very interesting when he was asked at what point do we leave Iraq? And he said, in essence, look, Iraq is a sovereign nation. And if the democratically elected government requests that we leave, then we have to listen to them. We have to listen to that government. Also, he said over and over again that he trusts the generals on the ground and that General Petraeus would be back here to report to Congress in September. I think the president and plenty of people on Capitol Hill are waiting and hoping that the surge policy that the president has put into place will show some signs of success, so that he could persuade Congress to fund the war even more, even longer. Mm. But if there are no signs of success or even any kind of positive movement, there will be incredible pressure on the president to change course. He avoided that this time. I don't know. It remains to be seen whether he will be able to do it again in September.
Susan Milligan, can we possibly have results in, what, 3 or 4 months that would substantially change the outlook for this war so significantly that the president will just keep getting the funds rolled over again and again? Or is he just going to go for that anyway, whatever the outcome there is?
Well, I can't predict what the president's going to do. I mean, he certainly made it very clear how determined he is to finish the job, although he may redefine what the job is. Mm. I do think it is going to get harder and harder for a lot of the Republicans on Capitol Hill and even some of the moderate Democrats who, you know, got elected in 2006 to continue funding the war the way it's going and as the 2008 elections approach. And I think in that sense, the Democrats have some hope, the anti-war Democrats have some hope in that if they just keep bringing up these votes over and over again, they can just, if things don't improve very much by the middle of next year, they can just hammer their opponents with those votes. And Republicans don't want to do that. They don't want to have to take those votes.
We're looking at a week in the news, the immigration fight, a no deadlines funding bill for Iraq, gas prices surging, and more. At a White House news conference yesterday, President Bush said the immigration reform bill now being debated in the Senate is the best approach to a tough issue.
If you're serious about securing our borders and bringing millions of illegal immigrants in our country out of the shadows, this bipartisan bill is the best opportunity to move forward.
But we heard it all week long, and on Monday from Senator David Vitter, Republican of Louisiana, that a key part of the new bill, the Z visa that would let folks in and stay, would reward people who are illegally in the country.
This Z visa is amnesty, pure and simple. It rewards folks for breaking the law. It lets them stay in this country without ever having to return to their homeland forever.
No, 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 said the president. He said that the bill does not let illegal immigrants off the hook.
Amnesty is forgiveness without a penalty. Instead, this bill requires workers here illegally to acknowledge that they broke the law, pay a fine, pass background checks, remain employed, and maintain a clean record.
Susan Milligan is with us from the Boston Globe, Gina Cavallaro from the Army Times, and Jonathan Capehart on the editorial board at the Washington Post. Jonathan, what about this thing? So much, sound and fury over it. Does it have a chance of getting through anyway?
It's one of those. Immigration, I think, has become maybe the new third rail in American politics. It used to be Social Security or any time you talked about touching an entitlement. This is one of those issues where you're not going to please everyone, and you have to somehow come to grips with an issue that impacts everyone and needs to be solved. And I think the president is right, I believe, when he says that this bill is not amnesty, because amnesty is, forgiveness without any penalties. It's probably not exactly what he said, but I thought what he said was the right thing.
The right thing, but Susan Milligan, with all this debate, does it have a chance of getting through? I mean, the sides are so polarized, and yet there's a sense that I'm getting out of Washington that maybe somehow this thing passes anyway.
You know, it sounds crazy, but I think it is going to pass, or at least going to pass the Senate. The thing is, no one likes this bill. Even the people who wrote this bill don't like this bill. And normally, that would mean that the bill isn't going to pass. I think this is actually one of those rare cases where that's exactly why it is going to pass. Because there are people who want to make changes in this bill on both sides. There are people who don't want to give legal status to the 12 million illegal immigrants who are living here now, even with penalties. There are people who don't want any guest workers here. They're concerned that that's going to create a permanent underclass of low-paid workers or will take away jobs from American workers. There's people who have problems with the way the visas are going to be handed out now, where there's more of an emphasis on someone's on the economic impact of someone's presence
their
here, education, you know, whether he was
and
a worker,
so on. Yep.
Right, as opposed to coming here, for being a family member of someone else. So a lot of people who want to change this bill, but there's really only one group of people for whom no bill is better than what they would consider a flawed bill, and that those are the people who are very sort of hardcore on the immigration issue and just want to, you know, get 12 million people who are illegally out of the country, which, I mean, I think when we saw what happened in New Bedford, we can see that that is not only a difficult thing to do from both an emotional standpoint and a bureaucratic standpoint. I mean, no one thinks that that's workable. No one thinks that you could actually track down 12 million people and throw them out of the country.
New Bedford, just one factory cleared out in Massachusetts.
Right, exactly.
President Bush saying yesterday, how do you get 12 million people out of this
exactly.
country? It can't be done. But that's kind of a cultural objection at the end of the day, isn't it? That real hardcore, is it economic or is it about race and color and the cultural makeup of the country?
Right. The thing is, I think that those people are a minority. They're certainly a minority in the Senate, which is why I actually think that this is going to pass the Senate. The House has never really been tested on this. They didn't vote on an immigration bill last year, and the year before they voted on a bill that was only about securing the border, so they've not been tested on this. I mean, I know that Speaker Pelosi is concerned about having some of their new Democrats from sort of moderate districts who narrowly beat Republicans in 2006 put on the line on this issue. But if they get a strong vote in the Senate, it'll make it easier for the House. I have to tell you that I found it kind of heartening. This is the first time in Bush's entire presidency that I have actually seen Democrats and Republicans in the White House sit in a room together for hours a day, several days a week, over 10 weeks, and just hammer out details on an issue where everybody gave something up.
And that's a lot of years you're talking about where that
no,
hasn't
No, but it's true because they never
you.
Had to do it before
right,
because
right.
they had Republican leadership in Congress and they didn't have to. And now Ted Kennedy is President Bush's best friend.
And he's got Senator Kyle right alongside on this of Arizona.
Absolutely.
Gina Cavallaro, there's an interesting military angle to this. We've got a lot of non-citizens at this point serving in the military, including in Iraq.
Oh, that's true. I'm glad you brought that up. Right now, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, used to be called the Immigration and Naturalization Service, there are 40,000 members, non-citizens in uniform, serving in all the services. And since the wars began in Afghanistan and Iraq, there have been non-U.S. citizens who have been killed over there. 98 of those have received posthumous citizenship. And that's gone up quite dramatically since the last time I checked that number, which is just a few months ago. But people who are in the military who are non-U.S. citizens have to have legal permanent resident status, which means they have a green card. It used to be that you'd have to be in the military for 3 years before you could even petition for citizenship. To join the military, you've got to have a green card, and then once you're in, you can immediately apply for citizenship.
Do you get a green card for joining up, or you've got to have it before you can join up?
No, you've got to have it before you join up, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yes, there are lots of these people serving in Iraq, Marines and soldiers that I've met. I've interviewed some of them, and I've interviewed some who, you know, on the phone from Iraq who have just taken the oath of allegiance and become U.S. citizens. Sometimes the Army will facilitate those phone calls. And they all say the same thing. They joined and they're serving because they wanted to give something back to their country. So it's really a unique group of individuals who have decided to become a volunteer soldier or a volunteer sailor, airman, marine, or Coast Guardsman.
And if killed, they get that citizenship posthumously, but that's...
Well, they can petition it. Their family can petition that. It's not automatic, but their family can petition, and they've granted 98 since the beginning of the wars.
That's what you call a very long road to citizenship. Let's take a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Shannon, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question about the immigration bill is, how is it going to be enforced? And where is the funding going to come from? For example, who's going to ensure that the heads of households go back and to their native country? Who's going to ensure that the $5,000 fines are going to be paid? Who's going to be keeping track of all of that? And then where's the funding for all of this going to come from? Thank you.
Yeah, good questions. Jonathan Capehart, there's been a lot of talk about enforcement. That's part of the bill. But, you know, we've seen immigration dictates before just not followed. So What about it? Who's going to enforce it? And how's it going to be paid for? Do people really believe that people will follow this circuitous path, even to leave the country to come back in on the new basis that would be offered here?
Well, you got to hope that Congress gets it right this time. I don't know the exact answer to the caller's question. My hunch is that it would be a mixture of law enforcement agencies, Homeland Security, Immigration Naturalization Service. Maybe some of the other panelists know exactly who would be enforcing this.
Susan, I mean, in the bill are what, more troops for the border itself, mm-hmm. hundreds of miles of more wall. What about for what ICE, the Immigration Oversight Agency? Mm-hmm. Will there be more staff there to chase this down if and when it's passed?
Well, I think part of the philosophy here is that, you know, you have 12 million people who are now living in fear every single day of being caught and being deported and so forth. And I think that the thought is that if you know that you can pay this fine and have the head of household go back and come back and then be legal, that, you know, that's a very strong incentive for people to sort of come out of the shadows and actually do that, so that that would take care of a lot of them. And if people who decided not to go through that process would then, of course, risk being chased down and deported. But see, now there's no, you know, there really isn't a path for them to become legal. So they have a little bit more of an incentive to just try to, you know, keep quiet and not get noticed. But I think that the hope, anyway, is that the way they have it structured, that will actually encourage people to come out and do that.
But some of the Republican opposition has said, look, you've had tough measures in immigration bills before, and it was all about the letting people in that actually ended up happening, not the enforcement of the tougher side of legislation. Is there an expectation that there'll actually be follow through on these triggers that are supposed to come before the path to citizenship is opened up?
Well, the triggers are a different issue. The triggers are security measures that have to be in place, and I believe certified by the Secretary of Homeland Security before they can go ahead with issuing some of these new visas. But I don't think that we've had a bill before that provides a legalization process for the people who are here illegally, where, I mean, it's onerous for a lot of them, I suppose, $5,000, and then making the trip back home, and if you're from Botswana, that's more complicated than if you're from Mexico, but at least there's a way to become legal, and there's that incentive for people. So it's not just, if it were just further enforcement, I suppose the concern of some of the proponents of the bill is that if it was only about enforcement, all that's going to do is drive the 12 million deeper into the shadows. And it's, again, as President Bush noted the other day, it is just almost physically impossible to track all those people down and throw them out of the country.
Let's go to Claude in Salisbury, Massachusetts. Claude, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have a quick comment about this. People who are really considering the possibility of throwing 10, 12 million people out of this country, I don't think they are aware of what they're talking about. Ask the Germans how they got rid of millions of people out of their country, and you have an idea. It would be a complete destruction of the very fabric of what this country is all about. It would be terrible. It would be, you know, it would be absolutely inconceivable. I cannot think of a way to this to possibly be done without, you know, a lot of suffering and a lot of destruction to our society.
And there's the president's point. It's just too big, it's just too much, and still there's so much opposition. Jonathan, you're on the editorial board. Where's your paper coming down on this in Washington at the Post?
Well, it's a tough issue, but we think that the bill that the president and Senator Kennedy have worked out is the right way to go. I mean, we have to look at the practical reality here, which the president mentioned, which we've talked about on this program. The idea that you are going to kick out 12 million illegal immigrants is just, it's, as the caller said, inconceivable. Yes, it would tear at the fabric of what this country is all about, but practically speaking, the jobs that many of these immigrants do, you know, help this country run. And the idea that you're going to kick all of these people out and then everything will be will still just be fine is crazy to me.
Let's go to Carolina Shores, North Carolina, and Teddy. Hi, Teddy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My feeling is that having decisions on the war be left to the military, as the president said, instead of the head politician, is not, I think, what is happening. In this weekend, when we honor the people who protect and defend our country and its ideals, I think this vote was close to a mockery of them. Our military did volunteer to put their lives on the line for us. But unlike in other wars, I don't believe there can be any good outcomes in this war. And the people who our armed forces trust to only send them to risk their lives for good reasons are now stuck in a terrible breach of trust.
So, Teddy, when you hear the president say, I want the military to make the decisions on this, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking that he's lying to us one more time.
That it's actually going to be at his end of the decision chain. Gina Cavallaro, how about it? What do officers think when they hear the president say that? Do they see it as their responsibility to figure out what to do in Iraq, or is this ultimately above their pay grade?
Well, the nature of what they do keeps them from discussing their views on what's happening politically in Washington. But I can tell you that when you're on the ground in Iraq and you're riding around in your area of operations and you've got soldiers under your command and you're General Petraeus and you've got every soldier over there under your command, you're trying really hard. You're working every day to establish the relationships with the local population. You're losing soldiers, but you're also making progress. The world looks a lot different over there to them than it does over here.
But we've heard top generals say, ultimately, there can only be a political decision, a political resolution to this situation in Iraq. It's just too messy, too sectarian. And then the president says, well, I'm going to do what my generals suggest, but you know, their instrument is military, not political. So, you know, do they really think that it's their job to figure it out?
Well, I think I've heard some generals talk about that. I also think that they want to continue to have a chance to make it work over there. The deployments, it's very difficult to imagine a sustained presence in Iraq for many years to come, especially when things just don't seem to be getting any better, and you can only send the troops over so many times before the families and the stamina of the army and the equipment can last. As far as the political solution, I think that some, you know, I've heard some generals say that they would love to see more State Department people over there, but we've heard recent reports about how dangerous it is for them too, and they don't have the adequate training or protection to survive in a war zone. I mean, not many people do. The State Department probably should have a bigger role, but that's some comments I've heard from some generals in that direction.
Right, and this week it was all about Congress. We're looking at a week in the news, the immigration fight, a no-deadlines funding bill for Iraq, gas prices surging, and more. It's also been a week of clanging and cooling off and crooning. Scientists in San Francisco desperately banged pipes to try and scare a stranded mother and baby humpback whale back to sea.
Hopefully it'll start driving the whale seaward.
Former President Jimmy Carter backpedaled on NBC's Today Show from his claim that President Bush's foreign policy was, quote, the worst in history.
My remarks were maybe careless or misinterpreted, but I wasn't comparing the overall administration, and I was certainly not talking personally about any president.
And American Idol saw its youngest winner ever, 17-year-old Jordan Sparks. Now she's a star. Susan Milligan of the Boston Globe is with us. Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post and Gina Cavallaro of the Army Times are here. John from Austin, Texas is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the new $100 billion appropriation bill for Iraq.
$120 billion when it's all in with the domestic and everything else. But yes, what's your question?
Yes. There are some tens of thousands of Blackwater forces in Iraq, and I wondered how much of the appropriations were going to Blackwater forces as opposed to our own military, and why we never hear about that in the media.
These are private contract workers, of course, who have done maybe more of what traditionally was done by the military in Iraq than in any other war. Gina, what about it? Is it broken out? Is that part of what will be paid for out of this funding bill?
Well, I'm not sure about the tens of thousands of Blackwater. Blackwater is one company. They provide security for State Department employees and other some private journalism companies. But there are tens of thousands of contractors on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. It is true that this is, I think, the first war where it's supported so much by contractors. And that would... yes, I would imagine would be part of it because it's part of the overall war effort. I mean, they're getting paid by different entities over there. The Army's got contractors working for it. The State Department has others. And then there are dozens of other entities over there that have contractors. So I would imagine that it's just part of the big war effort over in Iraq.
So like no other war, when the president says we've got to have funds for the troops, he's talking about civilian contract workers, armed and otherwise, who are very much in evidence in Iraq. John, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Iowa City, Iowa. Jean-Marc, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I guess my top story of the week, you mentioned American Idol, and mine is kind of so you can think you can dance, in the sense that I'm not sure if it's comforting or disconcerting to see so many people outside of reality, as I see Bush, and especially as relating to the Gonzalez story this week.
The Justice Department, Monica Goodling's testimony and all the rest, what do you see there?
Well, it's interesting, you know, I'm a big fan of The Daily Show, and oftentimes on The Daily Show, Jon Stewart does a story where he does a satellite interview between President George W. Bush and Governor George W. Bush, and he could do a similar thing with Gonzalez and the different testimonies he's given this week as relating to his deputy and all this sort of thing. I just find it so amazing that so little movement ever goes on.
You're looking at all the contradictions that emerged in that testimony and her saying she didn't remember things quite the way the AG did and, for that matter, others around him. Susan Milligan, what about it? It wasn't the kind of super breakthrough that we were led to kind of expect from Monica Goodling. On the other hand, she said the lines were crossed. She essentially said that the AG and his number two, their recollection didn't line up with hers. Where does that leave the Attorney General?
You know, I don't know. I'm honestly pretty surprised that he's still there, and I'm just trying to think from a personal perspective what it must be like for him to get up every morning and go to work, knowing that there's this whole team of people in Washington and around the country just trying to get him to leave, and they're going to have in the Senate in June, they're going to have a lack of confidence vote, and I can't imagine that that's going to be too much fun for him either. The only thing I can think of is that the White House has determined that it would not be a relief to ask him to leave, that all that would mean is that they would then have to go through a very painful and contentious confirmation process with a new attorney general nominee, and that they'd rather just leave him there. And of course, the president puts a lot of importance on loyalty, and certainly Alberto Gonzalez has been very loyal to the president.
Here's a bit of tape where Congressman Arthur Davis, Democrat of Alabama, was talking with Monica Goodling this week about an exchange she had with the attorney general where she indicated maybe he was trying to get stories straight with her that would later be presented. Well, interpret it as you will. They were talking about the firing of U.S. attorneys.
It made me a little uncomfortable.
What was it that made you uncomfortable about your conversation with the attorney general, Mr. Gonzalez?
I did not know if it was appropriate for us to both be discussing our recollections of what had happened.
Jonathan Capehart, is there no point at which testimony and all the insights we've gained add up to a weight that Alberto Gonzalez just can't carry in that office?
Well, I've been describing the Attorney General as sort of that Scott tissue, that paper towel in the commercial where they're trying to show you how strong it is. You can put a giant turkey on it.
Bounty.
You can put grapes on it. Bounty.
Yeah.
And it won't crumble under the weight. And I think Alberto Gonzalez is showing incredible resilience because he has a constituency of one. And when you know that your fate rests in the hands of one person, it's pretty easy to get up in the morning and go into the office no matter what's going on around you, because as long as President Bush has confidence in Alberto Gonzalez, and it seems like his confidence is unwavering, Alberto Gonzalez is not going anywhere. And we have to also keep in mind that Alberto Gonzalez so far has not been proven or shown that he has done anything illegal. It is the U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president, of the attorney general, and the president can fire and hire them at will. So until which time one of these people in the Justice Department sits in the chair and says that the attorney general of the United States did something illegal, there is nothing really that can remove Alberto Gonzalez from his job as long as President Bush has confidence in him.
But, of course, Susan Monica Goodling saying this week, I crossed the line when it came to political grilling of candidates for career positions. That's against the law, as she pointed out. He's her boss. Is he responsible for that? Will we ever figure out if he was directing that, if he was asking her to do just that?
Well, I think that's one of the questions Congress wants to find out. But yes, using political considerations for career staff is not legal. And, you know, I'm not sure that legality is even the issue here. I mean, there was a lot of pressure on President Bush to get rid of Rumsfeld. And I know a lot of Republicans on the Hill wish that he had done that a lot earlier. They thought it might have made a difference in some of the House races.
Sure.
And then Rumsfeld was gone about a half an hour after the Speaker-elect renewed her demand for his departure. So I don't know that it has to be proven that the attorney general has done something illegal before he's out. I mean, that whole episode with Mr. Comey and, you know, testifying about how Mr. Gonzalez, who was on the counsel of the president, and someone from the Justice Department going to the hospital bed of former Attorney General John Ashcroft and trying to get him to extend the wiretapping program. It was just incredible. So there's a lot of stuff building up here.
Susan, what did you make of the back and forth between Jimmy Carter and the White House this week? He was very tough in his opening comments in that. The White House came back very hard on him, and then what looked like a big backpedal by Jimmy Carter. What do you make of that whole exchange?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's saying anything that hasn't been said by a lot of other people. It's just, I think there's a sort of a former president club or something where you're not supposed to say anything particularly mean about another president. So I think I think it's pretty clear that Jimmy Carter doesn't think very highly of President Bush.
Let's go to Anna in Hamden, Connecticut. Hi, Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking my call, and I appreciate your forum. I'm just concerned. I heard a Marine Corps report yesterday. A unit came back from Iraq saying that they've only received 10% of the necessary equipment, you know, to help them fight this war. I don't understand where this fits into the scheme of President Bush's claim that he is out to support the troops.
After all these hundreds of billions, Gina Cavallaro, are we still seeing shortages? Is this the evidence you're describing of the Army being worn thin, Marines too, for that matter, on the supply side?
I think I saw that story, and I'm not familiar with where that came from. I know that they've done a lot to upgrade equipment over the past 4 years, and it is interesting or curious why the Army hasn't asked for the V-shaped hull. That's a tough one to say. Mm. V-shaped hull armored vehicles sooner. And suddenly now they're boosting the numbers. Marine Corps actually has those vehicles on the ground in Iraq now. They have about 100 of them in use over there, and they have some in production too. I think at the beginning of the war there were issues with getting things quickly, and they weren't ramped up to do it. They have spent billions. What's amazing to me is that these funds, this $100 billion that's quickly being ushered through, yeah, and now they're going to get it into the hands of the military so they can start paying for programs, isn't in the base budget. It's
also
kind of crazy
supplemental
way of doing
on top,
business.
not in the straight ahead books.
Right, it's like extra, you know, to fill the gap. I mean, $100 billion to fill the gap it puts a lot of stuff in peril and taking this long. I mean, they expected to get that money in April.
It's a lot of money, you would think. It would keep the troops well-equipped and covered. Let's go to John in Newport, Rhode Island. John, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. My comment is regarding the Iraq War. Every time the president is asked about it, he says, well, let's listen to the military, let's listen to the leaders. Almost without fail, they say that the solution over there is a diplomatic one. As a citizen, I'd be a lot more comfortable with him putting a diplomatic surge underway and putting a tremendous amount of effort there, which he does not seem to be doing. He seems to have the ability to use one tool. It seems to be a hammer, seems to be the military, and therefore every solution for him seems to be that way. And that's my comment.
John, let us pick it up. And thanks for that. Susan, there are supposed to be talks with Iran this weekend. The president did talk about the Iraq study group more enthusiastically, I think, than I've ever heard him before. He was pretty dismissive of it when Jim Baker and company came out with that months ago. So is there something diplomatic in the wings here? Is he looking for Plan B?
Well, I think there is some hope among some members on the Hill that the president is starting to open the door a little bit more to that, and especially because of the comments he made about the Iraq study group recommendations. It's not going to do the Republicans any good if this thing just drags out the way it's going for the next year and a half.
Let's go to Lauren in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to take it back to the Monica Goodling thing. I'm really upset that the Democrats were supposed to get this wonderful new oversight, and they squandered, to me, a real opportunity for oversight. Here they had this witness under oath, presumably advised by her attorney, not from a Christian Right law school, but from a real law school, that she had broken the law and she'd better take the Fifth. They had her under oath, and they didn't ask her. So who established the criteria for selecting people, you know, for political reasons? Who instructed you to do it? Was it the White House? She was sent over from the White House to justice, after all. What happened to the line of inquiry? And I'm so disappointed in the Democrats on the committee.
Jonathan Capehart, how about it? A missed opportunity here. There she was, already has her immunity. As Lauren says, she was under oath. Could they have done better with this big figure in the Justice Department, you know?
Well, Tom, I think the caller raises a very good point, and it's something that I had not thought of. But I do think each time someone goes before either the House Judiciary Committee or the Senate Judiciary Committee and fills in, you know, more pieces of the puzzle. So what was going on at Justice, what was going on between Justice and the White House, we get a fuller picture. I think that this idea that one witness is going to go before the microphone and tell the entire story is just not going to happen.
But the caller's looking for effectiveness here. I mean, how many bites of the apple do you get? You've already got a bunch of senior people who have resigned, given their testimony, and they're out of there. I mean, do they really have a deep bench of people to bring in to testify, or maybe they let a big one get away with Monica Goodling?
I don't know. I think we still have – I know it's frustrating to have all these bites at the apple, but this is something – what we're seeing is a very disturbing pattern of, you know, politicizing a department where politics should be left at the front door, where it's supposed to be about upholding the rule of law and not letting one's political views or affiliations get in the way of doing that. And the one thing that did come out of this is that we did hear from Monica Goodling that she did let politics play a role in her decision making. And while she would not say flat out that she broke the law, saying that she crossed the line is a pretty good euphemism.
Susan Milligan, one more bite on the Democrats and the war funding bill. You say the Republicans may pay a price if this goes forward without more success, but there's been a lot of anger among Democrats this week who wanted them to hang tough with the president, to tough out the veto. What Susan Estridge here calling the lily-livered Democrats lose game of chicken. You know, is there a price? She says, if this is the best they can do, what are they doing there? Is there a price for Democrats to be paid? Or do you see it as good politics to finally let the money go through before Memorial Day without deadlines?
Well, look, I think they're in a pretty tough position. I think, you know, obviously most of them did not want to continue to fund this war. But again, how long are you going to just go through this charade with the president where you vote and he vetoes and you vote and he vetoes? And I think if they kept doing that, that there would be a backlash against the Democrats. There's a New York Times poll out yesterday, reported today, that, you know, an overwhelming majority of people you know, don't like this war, and 61%, I think it was, including a majority of Republicans, said we should never have gotten into this war. But more than 60% also said they should continue to fund it for the time being, although they did want conditions on it. There weren't a lot of conditions put in this bill. But again, I think what they're going to do is they're just going to keep coming back at it and back at it and back at it.
Yeah, as the soldiers in the field must do, and as we all do, watching it unfold. Susan Milligan, national political correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks a lot for being with us on this very big Friday before the Memorial Day weekend. Susan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Gina Cavallaro at the Army Times. Gina, great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
It was a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And Jonathan Capehart at the Washington Post. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.